highly anticipated TV adaptation of Sally Rooney's debut novel, Conversations with Friends, is coming to RTE this week. The drama follows the global success of Normal People in 2020. The new series, Conversations with Friends, follows a 21-year-old Dublin-based college student called Frances, who, along with her friend Bobby, becomes involved in the life of a married couple, that couple called Melissa and Nick. Conversations with Friends is directed once again by Lenny Abrahamson, who also co-directed Normal People, and Element Pictures is producing this 12-part series. Delighted to have Lenny with us to chat about Conversations with Friends. And first of all, I have to go back to 2020. And I remember talking to you ahead of the release, actually, of Normal People, Lenny. We were in the first lockdown, very strange place that we were all in at the time. When did you start to get an inkling, when Normal People started to be aired, when did you realise this is a phenomenal success, better possibly than you had hoped or even thought was possible?
Hi, Sean. Yeah, it was pretty quick because it was released, I think, on a Sunday. And, people are sending you responses and, like, we'd had very good reviews and that was a lovely thing. But, reviews do not in any kind of predictable way translate into audiences. It's just impossible to know until something actually goes out there. And I think it was probably the Monday morning after a Sunday where we've been getting loads of anecdotal stuff back about numbers of people watching on the BBC iPlayer, for example, and then all of that stuff. And then lots of people, then huge amount of social media stuff. And then Monday morning more. And then I think by Tuesday or Wednesday, it was just a massive kind of tidal wave of, I don't even know how to describe it. I remember one more early on in the release, like a few days after, waking up and checking something online. And then everything I looked at seemed to be referring to Normal People, including a Brexit podcast that I used to listen to from the UK had a title with Normal People, a Normal People pun. And I remember thinking, God, I wonder if I actually woken up. Is this a kind of weird wish fulfillment dream that I'm in, or is it real? And it just kept building. It just didn't stop for months.
It really was a conversation point for a huge amount of time during that period of time. We'll come back to some of the conversation points later. But of course, the problem then is along comes Conversations with Friends after that huge success, 9 IFTAs, Paul Mescal winning the BAFTA, 4 Emmy nominations, all for Normal People. What do you do with that weight of expectation when it comes to working on Conversations with Friends? Very difficult, I would have thought, even to approach it.
You kind of just have to ignore it, I think. It's its own thing. The adaptation was, it's always a tricky thing to adapt a novel, and it's a complicated novel. And it took all our efforts collectively, Element Pictures, brilliant people in there, Emma Norton and Chelsea Hoffman and Ed Guiney, and then the producer, Catherine McGee, and all these people who came over, and Mark O'Halloran and Alice Birch again, brilliant writer called Maeve McHugh, like lots of great people all working hard to try and make this adaptation work. And you just kind of have to dive into that. And then production comes along and that's all consuming. And it's really only now, actually, in a funny way, coming out the other side with it finished and ready to go, that you sort of become aware again, oh yeah, every single person who talks about this show is going to compare it to Normal People.
Yeah, it's going to be the way. Yeah. What can you do about that, really?
Nothing. And you just have to say I think it's very much its own thing. There's a strong family resemblance, but more cousins than siblings, just let it be its own thing and let people find it and hope that people enjoy it. There's nothing else we can do.
I suppose, to give those who may not be that familiar with the novel, although I think Normal People, the television series, sent a lot of people back to Conversations with Friends, which was Sally Rooney's first novel. It sent them back to read that as a result. We're really dealing with a quartet at the centre of this new piece.
That's right. So the novel is from Frances's point of view, and it's a kind of coming of age story, really. But the way in which that story unfolds is through a series of really kind of complex relationships with three other characters. So you've Bobby, Frances's best friend and ex-lover. She's a brilliant character played by Sasha Lane. And then you have this older couple. I say older, like, to me, everybody in this is still very, very young. This couple are in their early 30s, whereas Frances and Bobby are in their early 20s. But you have this married couple who come onto the scene, and Frances begins to have feelings for Nick, the husband, and Bobby has feelings for Melissa, the wife. Yeah. And a very complicated set of configurations and reconfigurations of friendship and desire, and all of these things are at play. And it's through that kind of, through the process of untangling and tangling again with those relationships that Frances finally kind of, you know, transcends the situation that she's in at the start of the series. But it's a quartet. It's four very strong personalities as characters, and four really strong actors who are kind of anchoring the whole thing.
Yeah, I love quadrilateral. I saw somebody refer to it as in an article. That's a good way of putting it. Kenneth explains part of it. Frances is a student in Trinity College, as is her pal Bobby, and Nick and Melissa, then writer and actor respectively, are the two careers that they're following. But quite definitely an international. Alison Oliver is a total newcomer. Is she just out of the Lear Academy?
Yeah, she's just out of the Lear. When we cast her, she had just graduated. And so this is the first job she's ever had. And she is, you know, the entire show rests on her shoulders. She's in every scene. She's it's her story in a way. I mean, you know, very definitely her point of view. And so, yes, she's phenomenal. She's just an amazing actor. And it's, you know, the Lear continues to produce brilliant talent and nurtures people so well, and you know, and we were the beneficiary of Paul Mescal from the Lear, and now we're so proud to have Alison Oliver.
I suppose that there's more of an international feel certainly to the cast in this case, and they're not necessarily going against their countries of origin in some ways.
Yes.
Joe Alwyn as Nick, Melissa played by Jemima Kirk, and Sasha Lane as Bobby. Do you take things, and I know you will say to me, I went for the best person for the character, but do you have to take things into account now? Like, Normal People was a huge international hit. When it gets to the production and the casting, do you have to keep that in mind with your casting choices? Or will the producer be nudging you, saying, hold on a minute, Lenny, you got to keep this in mind. This could be an international possibility.
No, because what we've learned over the years is, like, when I did Room, Brie Larson wasn't known at all. And, you know, similarly with Normal People, it became an international hit because we cast the right people, you know, for the role. And we looked at, so many people for conversations with friends. So I can put my hand on my heart and say there was no pressure at all to do that thing that they say in Hollywood of casting up, you know, looking for names. It was, you know, the reason we went for the people we went for is they felt right. And it's fascinating to me that, like, you know, when you look at, say, Alison or Sasha, say compare Alison with Sasha. Sasha has got a profile, you know, she was in that wonderful film American Honey, she's in Loki, etc. But I don't think any of the actors were kind of household names in the sense that they would actually be the reason why people would watch something or not. Actually, people watch things that are good, and word of mouth does the work, especially on television. So no, we were really just trying to find the people that made sense of the parts to the greatest extent that we could. And we found these four wonderful actors, some of whom are better known than others.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to a clip if we can. This is from an early episode and they're at dinner at this stage. We should, I suppose, explain that the Bobby character and the Frances character are performance poets together, if you like. And Melissa and Nick, the older couple, as you say, I find the word older couple a little bit disturbing, but they are older. That's the reality of what happens in life. People who are 30 are older, but they're younger than you. Them in a conversation over dinner, and where they're talking about the whole idea of poetry and writing poetry and that type of thing.
Do you write other stuff, Frances? Like other forms, prose?
No.
Why not?
I like the impermanence of it, like the performance thing. I feel a bit sick when I think about it lasting forever.
That's so funny, because I always thought of writing is about some sort of desire for permanence. I feel like when I'm writing, I'm trying to get clarity. And then when I do, I want to keep it.
I think I'm trying for that, but it just doesn't feel possible.
Sure.
Or maybe I don't want to package it for people to own.
Francis is a communist.
Ah.
Thanks, Bobby.
Mm-hmm. So, books understood as commodities?
Maybe, in a sense. It depends. I mean, obviously, the really good ones are more than that.
The rest of us are just grinding it out on the production line.
And there we have a scene from Conversations with Friends, speaking with director Lenny Abrahamson this evening. And in that clip, Lenny, we heard Jemima Kirk as the writer, the older writer, Melissa Francis, played by Alison Oliver, and her pal Bobby, played by Sasha Lane, with that Barbie communist line thrown at her pal across the kitchen table. But particularly in the Francis character, I suppose this is something that we maybe associate with the writing of Sally Rooney, is a kind of a hesitancy on the part of sometimes of her heroes to find their way into expressing. They really are finding their own voices, which is difficult for an actor in that you're searching for stuff all the time as you go. But mm-hmm. There is a certain innate drama in that, but it's a very quiet, slow drama.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I mean, like, Frances is at that point in life where she's, like many people who are very intelligent or talented, which Frances is, like, also what comes with that is a terrible self-consciousness and self-awareness and a kind of crippling shyness that can kind of get in the way. And, you know, we're all kind of, I remember that, how narcissistic and self-obsessed I was at that age. And that's a very hard way to sort of go about, you know, to move through the world. And Sally is always interested in that. Connell has a degree of it, a huge degree of it in Normal People. But for an actor, it presents, a real challenge, because I think, you know, people who recede or who kind of hold back, you know, they're harder to grab hold of for an actor. And I think what's amazing about Alison's performance is she just found a vocabulary of gesture and just her whole way she holds herself physically really captures that awkwardness that people feel at, well, many of us feel at that age. And I think as well, from the filmmaker's point of view, from my point of view, Susie Lavelle, the cinematographer, and Leanne Wellham and Bobby Shore in the second block, it's about getting close enough and observing closely enough so that really comes out and you can feel the dramatic kind of emotional interior of a character who in a room might kind of recede.
Of course, the moment at which Normal People really found its voice, I suppose, in some ways, I'm being facetious obviously now, was the Liveline discussion around the sex scenes in Normal People. And what's your memory of that period, first of all, of that particular series of events, first of all?
Well, it was, you know, this was at the time when it was really at the sort of hype was at its height, and there was a real sense of feverish attention on the show. And I got a call from somebody involved saying, quick, switch on Radio One, you know, they're doing Normal People on Liveline. And what was brilliant was, so my wife, she's Polish and she lived here for about 20 years, and she spent so many times, she talked about how great and open and Ireland was as a place to live, where people didn't judge, and, you know, and there was a sense of I suppose liberality, you know, around socially. And I'd say, you know, you're right, it's true, but believe me, it wasn't always like this. And I tell her stories about what it was like in the early 80s, and she accused me of exaggerating. There's no way it could be really like that. So I dragged her in and I made her listen to this Liveline discussion. I could see the scales falling from her eyes, you know. This is, and I said, like, that's what it was like, sort of, but it was defanged when we listened to the show, because it's so much not the mainstream view, you know, and it became something, it became like almost nostalgic to listen to it. I certainly didn't feel like, I think it's a perfectly valid point of view that those people have. I'm not suggesting that they shouldn't feel the way they do or express it. I just think that it's not how most people think about sex or nudity or, you know, how that those things can be depicted. Mm. And that doesn't, you know, you can look at nudity and intimacy without that being pornographic. I firmly believe that. And I firmly believe we achieve that in Normal People. But listening to people kind of talk about it in that way just, I think, brought back the fundamental, actually one of the feelings I had when I read both books, which was, aha, this really shows the fact that these characters talk in the way that they do and live in the way that they do without that kind of shadow, it really shows you how much we've changed as a country.
The other thing is, I mean, and there will be, there may well be conversation over the sex scenes in Conversations with Friends.
For sure.
Based on, I've seen some of the episodes so far, and certainly the same explicit nature is there as was in Normal People. But I would also say the same gentle quality which you had in Normal People, which was, now this was, in Normal People you'd have a young couple experiencing very early sexual encounters, really.
Yeah.
But in some ways that coming of age aspect that is there in the Francis character allows that more gentle, perhaps, exploration of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ultimate truth in this is that it's the journey Francis goes on in this, across this story, is a positive one towards a kind of letting go of some of that, I suppose, awkwardness and narcissism, beginning to look outwards towards the people that she loves rather than inwards at herself all the time. And part of that road is travel with Nick. And a big part of why it's so powerful a relationship is that they have this intimate connection. I think Sally's, she writes about sex because sex is part of life and a really central part of life. And we wanted to honor that in this adaptation as well. And certainly Francis's experiences with Nick are positive. You know, they are part of what it is that sort of leads her out of herself. And so, as you say, that's a part of a coming of age story. And I think that allowed us to tell the story with, I think, tenderness, you know, in the intimate dimension as well as in the rest of the story.
Yeah, the other thing I wonder, just simply in terms of, now this was something, and because I had to pinch myself to remember that, yeah, yes, Normal People were talking about half hour episodes there as well.
Yeah.
But in the case of Conversations with Friends, we are, yes, half hour episodes, 12 of them, 12 of them in total to tell the story of the novel. But they will be shown, certainly in the RTE screenings, they will be shown two a night starting on Wednesday. And that does, I suppose, when you've got 2 half-hours, you've got 2 half-hour arcs. Whereas if you had a 1 hour arc, you know, you could kind of build through it. Was there much discussion around that particular formatting, and who ultimately had the say in how the adaptation went in that regard?
I mean, so we did discuss it. And what's interesting is it really works to show 2 of the episodes, but it works precisely, as you say, because there are 2 half-hour arcs with a gap in the middle. And that somehow does something to the audience. It makes you experience the story in a different way. And I think we found in doing Normal People like that, and that came quite quickly in the process of looking at it. We were all interested in a short form drama, you know, short, relatively short. Like, it used to be that comedies would be half hours and dramas would be TV hours, you know, and yet other things had sort of nudged at that, you know, nudged at that distinction and weakened it a bit. I think once we saw how well that worked with Normal People, we felt comfortable enough very early. I think I can't even remember how the discussions went, but I think we all felt, and the BBC felt, and Hulu felt very comfortable with that idea of going that way again, because it kind of suits Sally's writing.
Yeah.
You know, in that you want to get into real detail and nuance, and you want that feeling of presence. You know, you want to feel that you're right with those characters, and you don't want to have to deal with a lot of plot or B story or whatever, or the things that you often need to sustain that longer television hour. And I think you can be very pure and concentrate on one or two aspects of key relationships in a television half hour, which is really basically 25 minutes or roughly.
Yeah.
And I think that really works. It allows for a different sort of storytelling.
Was Sally Rooney more involved in this adaptation? Because I wondered, because it does have more of the flavour of the novel, if you like, in it. A 25 minutes is a kind of a chapter, really, isn't it? In some ways.
Exactly.
In terms of reading.
Yeah, like, so Sally's involvement here was lighter than it was in Normal People, because in Normal People, she was one of the writers along with Alice Birch, who came back to sort of lead the writing team on this one. But she was involved early on in sort of like that conversation. Yes, yeah. We should do it as a television. Yes, it should be short episodes. And she was very much involved in discussions about cast as well. But then she was pulled into the world of her new novel. So and was, in a lovely way, very happy for us to sort of, you know,
get on
do
with
what
things
we did the last time and take it on.
I want to listen to another clip, actually. I had to look twice at this particular character because I thought, I knew that face. This is a character called Philip. Yeah, a character called Philip, who has a beard, actually, in this particular case.
And quite a sort of posh accent.
Yeah, a much posher accent than perhaps we might associate with his previous roles, which were very associated with Cork. But here is Frances, played by Alison Oliver. She's got a summer job at a publishing house, paid to read and give her opinion, and she's... this character, Philip, played by, well, you'll hear, see if you can work it out and I'll tell you afterwards who it is.
Great. So you can kind of sit wherever.
Hmm. Where do you sit?
Here. Kind of a hot desking thing.
Oh. So I can read to you?
No, you read to yourself in your head. Oh. And then you write a report.
So I sit here and I make an assessment on someone's abilities when I'm not qualified. And I'm fundamentally opposed to the whole notion.
You said you wanted this job, Frances.
What happens if I have a shit morning? Do I just make arbitrary decisions and we use that as a test of cultural excellence?
Don't get excited. You write it, I read it, and if you happen to have an undiscovered genius in that pile, then maybe someone more important might get to hear about it.
All right, then.
There we have it. Alison Oliver as Frances. And did you recognise at home the voice of who was playing the character of Philip? It is, of course, Alex Murphy from Young Offenders with a Beard. But I particularly wanted to play that clip because it struck me, Alex, we see him in a maybe perhaps a more dramatic role than we necessarily associate him with, as we do with Tommy Tiernan in a different section of the piece as well. Seemed that not that Alex is a stand-up comic, he's an actor, but that kind of crossover between comedian and, I suppose, straight player seems to be more prevalent now than it was in previous times.
For sure. And actually, I mean, you know, comedians make great straight actors. I've come across it again and again, like, you know, Pat Short in Garage. And like, I love working with comics. And Tommy is, both Alex and Tommy are brilliant in the show. And Alex's character is like, there's a playful dimension to how he plays Philip, but he's a magnificent straight actor, Alex. And Tommy's character is as dark as anybody is in this show. And he's absolutely brilliant. Like, and he takes his work as an actor incredibly seriously, Tommy. Like, you know, there's often plenty of joking on set, but I can tell you none of it comes from Tommy. Yeah. He's like, he really respects the craft and he's really serious about it. And I think that will show for anybody who watches it. He comes first up in Ep 2, so you'll see it on the first night's broadcast.
Well, Tommy has proved his chops in a few different fields now as well. He proved in the presenting field as well, hasn't he?
Indeed.
Finally, just as we finish up, you mentioned there that Sally Rooney, when you were starting work on this, was quite happy to get on with her new novel. Are we talking about Beautiful World, Where Are You? And are we talking about have discussions started around a potential adaptation or anything there, Lenny?
No, as of yet, no. I mean, from my point of view, like, I'm really keen to get back to, well, my first thing I want to do is some writing. I have something I'm trying to work on myself as a screenplay, and I'm going to take time to do that this year. And then I really want to make a film. You know, it's been a while since I've made a film now, and that's kind of where I'm leaning towards. And I think for her part, from what I understand, I think Sally wants Beautiful World to kind of live as a novel for a period before it, whether she, you know, I don't know whether she's thinking about an adaptation or not in the long term, but I think for now she's happy for it to be something people read.
Any idea of what your own film might be?
I feel like it's always better not to talk about it and then do it, or at least talk about it when it's a little bit more real. But yeah, it's a more personal project, about my own sort of history and family and stuff like that. So that's where the territory is.
Right. Well, lovely to speak with you as always, Lenny, and congratulations on Conversations with Friends. I hope it brings you as much success and maybe even more, I would hope, for you, the normal people, which, let's face it, was quite a success.
Thanks so much, John.
Lenny Abrahamson there, and Conversations with Friends starts on RTÉ1 television this Wednesday, 9:30. The series will air over 6 weeks, 2 episodes each Wednesday night. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. The Innocents is a new feature film from director Eskil Voigt, who was an Oscar nominated alongside Joachim Trier for the screenplay for The Worst Person in the World. The Innocents is a tense psychological horror set in Norway, telling the story of four children living in the same housing estate who, when left to their own devices, reveal their dark and mysterious powers. While exploring their newfound abilities in the nearby forests and playgrounds, their innocent play takes a darker turn and strange and sinister happenings begin to occur. Delighted to be joined this evening by Eskil Voigt to talk about this. I'm calling it a psychological horror. There certainly are very dark aspects to your story here. Eskil, could you tell me what were the beginnings of the story?
Well, the very beginnings, and some people get the wrong idea when I say this, is that it was inspired by having kids, by my children. but it's more in that the sense that having kids reminded me about childhood and how different it is to be a child than to be an adult, how radically different it is. And it made me curious about childhood again. And I got this feeling would have been an interesting film to make about the secret world of childhood.
Funny, I it struck me there is a television series here called The Secret Life of Kids, and I thought this is a little bit in that area, in that we're observing these children as they play, and play in a way that they're unaware of adults, and they don't really want adults butting in on what they're doing.
Yeah, that's true. And I remember it's partly the setting of the film, which have these huge apartment buildings right next to the forest, is based on my own childhood experience of living a place like that. And I can still remember that feeling of being in your apartment with your parents watching or just next door and going outside, and would still be people walking by. And you could just turn right, walk like 100 feet into the forest, and you were completely alone, you know, and you could have this freedom as a child to experiment and play or go completely Lord of the Flies for an hour or two, and then you go back and sit down for the dinner table at your house. And I really felt that was a wonderful setting for a movie.
And that, I suppose, the forest is there's an idyllic quality to it, and the idea that you could, as you say, be in a concrete apartment block at one level, and 100 yards around the corner you were in this idyllic forest setting. That is both dangerous and exciting. I guess that's part of what you're looking at here.
Yes, it is. It is exciting when you're a child. You need those spaces when you're completely alone. I think that's a natural part of growing up, is that you can be on your own and test some boundaries, make some mistakes and learn from them, instead of having your parents hovering over you all the time. But that also means that you can make, in some occasions, you can make grave mistakes that you will regret. But I think it's also very... It's part of the excitement of being a child is to go away from your parents and try to figure out stuff on your own.
Yeah, we often hear the term helicopter parenting being used nowadays. I mean, do you feel, looking back on your own childhood in that situation of the apartment block beside the forest, is it very different from modern day childhood in Norway? Are children more watched than perhaps you were as a child?
Much more watched now. And I think it's basically a good thing, because I feel that now both parents in most two-parent households are now almost equally involved in their kids and more invested and everything. But that time when kids are free to make their own mistakes is very limited now. And we're very careful and we try to protect them. And you can't protect them, you know. They have to go out in the world and do stuff that they'll regret and inflict pain on others in their love lives or in just whatever. And it's a hard thing to accept for a parent, for me as a father, that they need to do that.
And you say inflicting their love lives, but in the case of the four children really that we look at, it's four central characters that we're looking at here, two sisters, Ida and Anna. And Anna is a character who has autism. And then we have two neighbours, Aisha and Ben. Aisha and Ben kind of in some ways are the two characters who seem to be the ones with the extraordinary powers, which are exciting but quite frightening. How real are the powers that they have? If you want to tell me a little bit about the powers and what you were looking for in giving them those particular powers.
Well, in the beginning, it was more about the magic of childhood. That was one of my first ideas, is that what if a group of kids were playing together and something magical, inexplicable would happen, you know, and they would just go along with it as part of their playing. Mm. And then they would go home and sit down at the dinner table or in front of the television, and that magic wasn't there anymore. And you would think that was just their imagination, even though it felt real. But I thought, would it be interesting to make a movie where that magic was real? And so it was about the magic of childhood and the powers of being able to move things lightly with the power of your mind, or having sort of telepathic contact that came out of that. We came out of that idea that I wanted to show that kids live in a different world where there's much more emotion, and they have the difficulty separating what's real and what's not, and all that we don't have as adults. Yeah. You know?
Ben and Aisha display those two powers respectively, this ability to move things or make people move in certain directions, and another, in Aisha's case, that kind of telepathic connection. What we end up getting in fact is, rather than, you know, making decisions about will they play in the dangerous spot, will they climb a bit higher up that tree than perhaps their parents would let them, we get ourselves into a situation where these children are learning about moral decisions. How moral do you think a child is? You know, are we talking tabula rasa in the very beginning in your mind?
I think so. I mean, you know, we have this cliche that kids are born like they're pure angels, you know? And I think you can argue that the opposite is true, that you're born as a narcissistic, egotistical sociopath. And luckily, you're very small, so you can't really do that much damage. But you have to learn empathy and morals. You develop empathy and morals very in a very different rhythm. You know, some get it very early and some much later, but you still can become a very empathetic, productive person later in your life. So I really early when I thought, okay, the magic of childhood, the need to have powers, what will happen if children have powers? Well, something bad will happen. You know, you don't give a 10-year-old a gun, you know, something bad will happen. They're not supposed to have that kind of responsibility. But it also kind of heightens, I found, the experience that I have and a lot of people have that I talk to. Almost everyone has that childhood memory that they regret of being cruel, of being cruel to animals or other kids, especially younger siblings they've been through a lot when you talk. Why is that, you know?
I think there's a very specific memory in your own case regarding an air gun or a gun, a pellet gun, and a poor pigeon. Now, confess.
It was actually a seagull.
A seagull.
And I had this air gun with compressed air shooting small lead bullets that I was allowed to use when we were on vacation, because there were no one around. So they probably thought it felt safe. And I remember aiming it at the seagull flying overhead and firing. And I remember that I hit it because I could see it move midair. But seagulls they're big birds. So it didn't like just fall out of the sky dead. It just kept flying. And I remember feeling so bad about that, because I've read somewhere that lead was poisonous, or I heard it probably because I was very young. And so I imagined that bird dying slowly in agony somewhere because of me. And it didn't even occur to me to talk to my parents about it, probably because I felt I did something wrong, but just didn't occur to me, which is also something that we as parents need to remind ourselves that our kids, they walk around with these things inside of them that they don't share with us. And I remember having trouble sleeping and thinking about it. And looking back at it, I feel maybe that's why there's so many memories about transgression when you're a child, because for me, that was an important lesson, you know?
Yeah.
I shouldn't be cruel to animals or creatures that are not as strong as me, you know? Yeah. It became part of my moral compass. Mm-hmm. And before that, my morals were just the ones handed down to me by my parents. You shouldn't do this. You should always do that. And you can't go through life doing stuff just because your mother told you to do it. Or, I mean, at some point, you need to find your own set of values and morals. And I think that's why we do that stuff when we're kids.
It sounds a bit like as if the innocence might be your apology to that seagull all those years ago. It
has haunted you. I'm so sorry. And to all that seagull's family, you know, it's
still on your mind. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is the older sister character, the character of Anna, and all four of your young actors are quite extraordinary in this. The character of Anna has autism. What was the idea behind that particular quality in the character of Anna, and where did that come from?
It came a little bit later. I had already this idea of the magic of childhood and wanted to make a story about the secret world of childhood. And then by accident, I read an interview with a Norwegian author called Olaug Nilsen, and she had written very open-heartedly about her experience with her son, who was autistic, and also something she labeled regressive autism, which meant that her son had evolved normally, typically, with language skills and communication and everything, eye contact, until he was 3 or 4, and then he just lost his language and withdrew into this, lack of a better word, autistic bubble. And I had a daughter the same age when I just felt, oh no, that's for me is a horror movie, mm-hmm. you know? Because I think I could deal with having a child that was born nonverbal autistic or with any kind of disability and just love that child as he or she is. But to have the impression that you lost something, you know, that that your kid is inside that body somewhere and you can't communicate with him, that just felt like a nightmare and a very complicated grief. And it just haunted me for a long time until one day I sat down at my desk while writing, saying, well, maybe this should be part of my story. I was already making a story about that closed off world of childhood that adults don't have access to, and what's more closed off than a nonverbal child. And it just fit perfectly, because then also there would be that complicated relationship with the other sibling who felt the autistic sister gets too much attention and has these feelings of jealousy that she can't feel, she can't communicate and talk about, and that creates such an interesting dynamic. So, of course, then I did a lot of research and met parents and observed kids with that diagnosis and tried to not make it like, I've made a supernatural fable, you know, where I can also tell that story that moved me so much about losing contact with your kid. But also I felt if I have that element in my story, I really need the details to feel real enough for people who are actually living it.
Thanks for speaking with us this evening, Eskil. That's Eskil Fucht, and Eskil's film The Innocents will be in cinemas and on digital platforms from this Friday. After Beethoven is the title of a series of chamber music concerts being staged at the National Concert Hall during the months of May and June. The series allows five contemporary composers to celebrate the legacy of Beethoven by presenting a newly commissioned work of their own, which responds to the enormous creative legacy of one of music's most important composers. These newly commissioned works are presented alongside selected compositions from others, which also pay tribute to Beethoven's legacy. Concert kicked off at the National Concert Hall last Wednesday and continues on Wednesdays throughout May and June, as I said. With me this evening, two of those involved, Gareth Shaldis and Jane O'Leary, whose concerts will be staged on June the 8th and June the 15th, respectively. And, you know, let me just start with a piece of music by Beethoven, which might be the way to let the man himself have the first word. And this is a piece that Jane has chosen for us actually to listen to. Section there of one of Beethoven's six bagatelles from Opus 126, that in fact the fifth of those sixth bagatelles, played by Alfred Brendel, and a piece that was chosen for us this evening by Jane O'Leary. I suppose, Jane, in some ways, when we hear that word bagatelle, it suggests something small, something flippant, something unimportant, that the phrase a mere bagatelle. When Beethoven gives us a bagatelle, there's probably a little bit more substance in there, is there?
Oh, yes, there is, Sean, definitely. I know the term bagatelle kind of means a small thing and they call them little pieces. But when I discovered these, I found a completely new Beethoven. I mean, we think of him in terms of his nine great symphonies and his 32 piano sonatas and these enormous works. But the bagatelles really changed the course of music because they were small, they were short. But they were contrasting and full of life and contrast and very improvisational, actually, and unpredictable. And that's what I like about them. They're just little gems. Mm.
And in fact, listening to that performance by Alfred Brendel, of course, a pianist who can make the most simple thing, well, getting it to sound simple is the real skill in the first place. For Elise would be one of the bagatelles, an earlier bagatelle, a set of bagatelles that Beethoven, and people will know that tune. He really has very small ideas, but he does an awful lot with essentially a couple of notes.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's the thing you admire most about Beethoven is how he can draw an enormous piece out of a few notes and keep it interesting, you know, hold your interest all the way and extract everything from a tiny amount of material. And that's something which interests me a lot and helped me, you know, in
your own responses for your concert. Yeah. I suppose, yeah, we only have to think of the four notes at the beginning of the Fifth Symphony. Gareth sitting in front of me here in Dublin. He got quite a lot out of four notes when you think of that Fifth Symphony, really, didn't he? What does Beethoven represent for you? Or he's at such a cusp, really, a really important point in that changeover from classical into romantic, you know, and you could argue the toss that Beethoven kind of sits on both sides of the fence at different times, doesn't he?
I think so, yeah, definitely. I think you can view him in both respects. I mean, for me, it is this thing that you've just been speaking about with Jane. It is this aspect in his work, this way of drawing every last possibility, every last creative possibility out of very small pieces of material. Maybe more than anything aesthetic or stylistic or even specifically technical, it's about an approach, a way of thinking musically.
And Jane mentioning the nine symphonies there, it's such an enormous body of work that he has. You think of the piano sonatas, think of all the other sonatas. In fact, you've chosen a cello sonata for us as a piece that we might listen to suitably. What was it about this piece that spoke to you?
Well, actually, this is, I suppose, maybe I'm drawn to this work and to others of Beethoven's middle period because... there are sometimes moments where Beethoven the melodist, when Beethoven the melodist, I suppose, transcends Beethoven the craftsman, trying to really work with small pieces of material.
We might consider Beethoven in terms of building blocks, that he puts blocks together rather than big long lines of melody. But this piece that you've chosen for us is a different aspect of his work.
This is Beethoven very much involved with melody, and when Beethoven gets involved with aria like this, it just melts me.
Right, and it's a cello sonata, so what better instrument to give a melody to? This is the Adagio movement, the second movement from the Sonata number 5 in D major for cello. Section there of the Sonata number 5 in D major for a cello. And it was Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist, playing that piece for us with Emmanuel Axe on piano. Accompanying on piano, or does he give, does Beethoven later on in that piece, Gareth Childers, who chose it for us, does he give equal weighting to both instruments?
Yeah, definitely. Often with the cello sonatas and the violin sonatas, you feel sometimes as if it's the string instrument accompanying the piano.
So Jane, then, I mean, part of the remit that you have in terms of the concert is to take the work of Beethoven or a specific work within Beethoven and respond to it with a newly commissioned work. But before we get on to what you're doing with the newly commissioned work, we can go back to that, the bagatelles, because had you done this previously, responded to those bagatelles in some way, or had they inspired you in your own five bagatelles that you, your composition, your own composition?
Yes, very much. I had listened to them in a concert and been very taken by them. And in 2013, I was actually commissioned by Music for Galway to write a piece. And I decided to call it Five Bagatelles because I really like the idea of just writing short pieces rather than stretching it out, you know. When that didn't seem, it's more like writing a poem instead of a novel, for example. And I like to write music that just focuses on a certain feeling, and it's done. And so I had written these five bagatelles, and when the question of celebrating Beethoven's 250th birthday came up for this program, I thought it would be really lovely to hear my bagatelles beside Beethoven's. So I've chosen to intersperse my five with his six. So you're going to hear like Beethoven, me, Beethoven, me.
And how, and so how cheeky did you feel doing that? Or how did you feel about saying, yeah, I'm going to divide up these five works? I suppose in many ways it's a set of bagatelles rather than five movements that are kind of necessarily sitting together and not to be interrupted.
In a way, and I think it'll reflect on each of them and we'll hear them quite differently. Mm. I know Beethoven intended it to be played as a cycle, that the six would be together. Yeah. But I think this will give us a new reflection on both his and my music.
Yeah, so. I suppose that's what it does. It gives us a sense of both. I'm going to play the third of your five, which then that comes between numbers three and four of Beethoven, isn't that right? So what are you responding specifically to the one that's just gone in front of it? Or it doesn't work quite like that?
No. I wasn't referring specifically to it at all. It was more the idea of small pieces just capturing a mood and saying something and being put together into a collection.
Yeah, so a little bit of him and a little bit of you is what we're getting here. Let's have a little bit of you, since we had a little bit of him earlier on. And this is the third of Jane O'Leary's Five Bagatelles. And the performer here is Maria Somareva. So just a little section of the opening of Jane O'Leary's Bagatelle number 3 from her Five Bagatelles, which, as we said, will be interspersed with the six Bagatelles of Beethoven on the night. And again, working with a very small amount of material there, Jane, and expanding it out. You're following in Beethoven's, you're taking his lead, really, in what you did with that composition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I guess I always do. Just that's the way I work, kind of holding on to material and seeing what I can do with
it. Yes, getting as much from it as you can. Tell me a little bit then, Garrett, about what you have responded to in terms of the new composition, first of all, that we're going to get at your concert on the 8th of June.
So, yeah, the new piece I've written is called Circling Tracing. And it's for cello and piano. It's concerned with cycles and repetition, but the music is kind of ultimately static, I guess. The materials are really fragmentary, almost like husks of material.
And was there a specific Beethoven piece that you were responding to, or is it, again, more of a feeling across his way of working?
It wasn't a specific piece. It was more of a feeling and kind of personal tactile memories. Mm. Remembering myself as a teenager playing some of the sonatas and the chords resonating up through the keys. These were the sorts of things that were kind of haunting the music. But so it really is an echo or several echoes.
And in your case, Jane, I think there was a very specific, was it a piano sonata or a section from a piano sonata that you, it's not that you're responding to it, but it was kind of the start, the beginning of this piece, as the wind often does.
Yes, that's right. The Opus 10, number 3 piano sonata. I searched through to see, was there a motif or something I could build on from Beethoven? And the opening three notes of that sonata are just very suggestive. And Beethoven often starts with a question and just a little, like, must it be Musa sein, that piece that begins with three notes also. And it suggested a kind of uncertain world, a questioning, which then he transforms into a very positive, cheerful theme. And I liked that idea. I also liked the idea of the rondo, which is a form he used often at the end of a sonata for the final movements. Right. So mine is also a rondo in a different way. in a sense that there's this rhythmic section and then there's very free sections and they alternate within the piece.
And it features bass, clarinet, violin, cello and piano, and that will be the world premiere, obviously, that we're getting on Friday, the 15th of June in the Case of Jane's concert. And it will be a world premiere for your piece too. It will be the first time out for Gareth as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because they were new commissions. Well, thanks to both Gareth Shaldas and Jane O'Leary speaking to us about After Beethoven's series of concerts at the National Concert Hall in Dublin. Second concert takes place Wednesday the 18th of May. Concerts every Wednesday through until middle of June. Full details about the concerts on the Concert Hall website, nch.ie.